our interviews about Lash and MSU, and I guess particularly we were talking about worker education, labor ed.
Oh, yeah.
But I think we kind of had finished that, to tell you the truth.
I think we did, because I don't have very much to say on the subject.
Yeah, I think we were kind of done on that. Another interest of mine is the subject of the attempts to unionize the faculty here at MSU and the issue about the faculty grievance procedure.
Yeah.
And if you'd be interested or willing in talking about either of those subjects,
no problem.
I'd love to.
See, they, I think, appeared by coincidence, actually. The first serious effort, the first effort to organize the faculty occurred before I got here. I think it was the late 40s, when a group of people, most of whom I think were in the English department, joined the American Federation of Teachers. And they're probably, from what I've been told, there couldn't have been more than maybe 10 faculty members who were actual members. But because they were starting to talk about the desirability of a faculty union, four or five of them were fired. And I don't know why they didn't go to the AFL. Well, I think I know why they didn't go to the AFL. It wasn't a very progressive outfit in those days. But instead, they went to Gus Scholl, who was the president of the state CIO, and asked for his help. He got in touch with the trustees, who some of whom were elected by on the Democratic ticket. And I don't know exactly what he told them, but in any event, within a couple of days after his intercession on behalf of these faculty members, they were reemployed and the thing died down. But the AFT didn't have much support from the faculty in those days, so that was a pretty ephemeral effort.
Do you happen to know the names of any of those faculty?
I'm trying to think. The Russ Nye, who later became a Pulitzer Prize winner, and from my standpoint, liberal, middle-of-the-road Democrat, I guess. He was one of them, a guy named Weisinger, Herb Weisinger. See, both of these people have left here. Russ Nye by retirement. I don't even know if he's still alive. Herb Weisinger left and went to Stony Brook in New York about 20 years ago, I guess. Adrian Jaffe is dead. He was another one. See, it's too far away from the late 40s for any of these people still to be around here. Now, Walter Adams was here at the time, and he remembers this. He didn't join AFT, but he was an observer of this event with great relish, and he likes to tell about how when they went down to see Gus Scholl, I think actually when they were in his office, he made a phone call over here. He was down in Detroit and got the thing straightened out. I can't remember any other names than those.
Do you think Walt would be willing to talk on tape?
Oh, yeah, he would. I think he would, yeah. So anyway, that was one attempt. So it didn't last very long, didn't come to much. Then, if my memory serves, the first major effort to organize the faculty came in 72, when the MEA supported a group calling itself Faculty Associates, most of the leadership of which was centered in the old University College, and with some people in LIR also, of course, supporting that effort. And when the MEA began talking about the desirability of a faculty union, the AAUP had to decide what was its position on the question. And it was very difficult for them. AAUP wasn't a very big organization anyway. Most of the members, as I remember, were opposed to unionization. But they had to consider that if the MEA were to win an election, that would end the AAUP on the campus. So they underwent a kind of deathbed conversion to collective bargaining, and they put themselves on the ballot. But the program they put forward was so flabby, there was so little content to it, that it was almost a parody of a union organizing program. And then there were two other outfits that got themselves got into the effort to organize. One was headed by some guy in engineering. I have no idea who they who the man was. But this was an anti-union group. Mm-hmm. They wanted to get on the ballot, and they said, if we win, then they won't, we will, mm-hmm. we will drop the whole idea of unionizing. And a fourth, I can't remember what this fourth group was. Might have been AFT, I'm not sure, but it wasn't very large. The MEA put a lot of effort into it, and money, and circulated letters and leaflets to the faculty and so on. Well, I looked at these programs of these outfits, and they looked so damn weak to me that I couldn't take them seriously.
Any of them?
None of them.
Uh-huh.
So I was discussing this with a reporter from the State News one day, and he said, I got an idea for a story. This guy was a columnist. His name was Louis Bender, very creative guy, Vietnam veteran, a little older than the run-of-the-mill students and so on. He said, let's concoct a story to the effect that you have been retained by the Teamsters Union to organize the faculty, and you've made a deal with Jimmy Hoffa. He hadn't gone to jail yet. Wait a minute, this is 72. Oh, we figured he was going to be out. That was it, in time, say, something like that. So the upshot of it was we went out to a bus stop close to town here and waited, and had a photographer with us, waited till the truck, you know, big over-the-road truck rolled in. And then I went up to the driver, and I had a briefcase that had a free Hoffa sticker on it. And I didn't know whether this driver was going to be pro-Hoffa or against him, so I didn't let him see the free Hoffa sticker. But I held the thing in such a way that the photograph, which appeared on page one of the State News, big photograph, showed me with my foot on the running board of this truck, and I'm talking to the driver who's looking out, wondering, sort of bemused, wondering, what the hell is this? And then you can see the free Hoffa sticker, see? So then we had an interview. This was a page one story in the State News, a big picture, see? Hmm? Above the fold, as they say, the top
right.
of the page. And then we had this interview in which I was talking in a very ungrammatical way. And this guy was asking me, well, how come you're trying to organize for the Teamsters? And I says, well, look at these namby-pamby outfits that are trying to organize the faculty. There isn't one of them that has a program that's worth a tinker's damn. I said, what we need is a real union. The Teamsters will take a bite out of management's arm if they give us any trouble when we get them up to the bargaining table, a bunch of bunk like that. It was a fairly long story. Well, I suppose you could say that was not very constructive or helpful to the union effort, but I couldn't take these outfits seriously. Uh-huh. They were so primitive from my standpoint. And I knew, I was virtually sure the faculty would never vote for a union anyway, which they didn't. They voted about 60% no, 40% yes. And I, in trying to figure out why the vote would go that way, came to this conclusion. I would guess that about, and I never checked this out carefully, but I would guess about two-thirds of the faculty at that time were tenured in associate and full prof, say. Had it made. In talking to them, I could tell they didn't see any need for a union. They figured if they have a union, that's going to be one more institution they have to deal with, pay dues to, if they're going to have anything to say about what the union does, they're going to have to go to meetings and so on. We already have this sham faculty governance system here, which takes time and effort if you care about what goes on. And so they just didn't see a need for it, personally. Most of them had figured out a way, some sort of accommodation with their department heads and their colleges, and while they grumbled about salaries, I think most of them knew they were paid about equal to their contributions, which were fairly meager in most cases anyway. So they voted no. And so you had young people voting yes, and a few disgruntled older people, and then some people who ideologically were tuned into the idea unions are good for other folks, probably good for us. And there was your 40%. That's the way I sized it up. During the course, I guess it was the next effort. So that went down to defeat. That was a MERC
right.
elections, the secret ballot election on the campus. Then we had another vote in, I think it was 78 or thereabouts. And this time the MEA put a lot of money and energy and, into that organizing drive with, I forget now, it seemed like half a dozen letters to the faculty and so on, with a pretty impressive program. The AAUP by 78 had come around to the idea that collective bargaining was acceptable. I think because around the country the AAUP represents faculty in a fairly large number of schools now. So if the national AAUP has embraced collective bargaining, I think again it's a deathbed conversion to it, to head off the AFT or local branches of the NEA. But anyway, they do, see. So the local AAUP came out for collective bargaining. I don't remember, there was no anti-union organization that I can remember then. But some of the people in Econ, some of my pals in Econ, I think about half a dozen of them, wrote a letter, a one-page letter, and distributed this to the faculty all over the campus, urging a no vote. See, you wouldn't call that an organized group, just a group of people who apparently were sitting around the coffee room talking about the upcoming union election and decided we better come out against it. And they gave all the typical economists' reasons for opposing a union. And when I took a look at that letter, I thought one, while I was somewhat ambivalent personally about the need for a union, I didn't care much for this anti-union letter. And then on top of that, it was written as if the writers had a writing skill at about the ninth grade level. And these are people with PhDs, but they were, it was ungrammatical, the style was lamentable, it was just a wretched letter. So I decided, I've got to take this one on, so I wrote a column poking fun at this idiotic letter of theirs, which the MEA liked well enough to put in one of its organizing leaflets or publications. But that went down to defeat by almost exactly the same percentage, 60% no, 40% yes. And I analyzed it in, just in my head in the same way that I had the first one, my explanation of why the vote was that way. Then we had a third election, this time in the early 80s, when we had a president here who had managed to antagonize every possible group that I can think of. He started out antagonizing the alumni, then he, then the legislature got their backs up in part because of the way he went after the Alumni Association. Then he had the students opposed to him, the faculty were complaining about him. And there was even a threat that we would have to lay off tenured faculty because the university was on the shorts, the economy was in a slump in the early years of the Reagan administration, the auto industry was down, that meant tax revenues to the state were down, and when they're down, then what the university gets goes down, and so on and so on. Well, even in that atmosphere, with, again, a major expensive effort launched by the MEA, the vote came out 60% again, as I remembered. No, 40% yes. So I pondered, I claim to know something about unions and union organizing efforts and so on. And I remember offering a suggestion, I think, to some of the MEA people, who again were centered, and the MEA organizing drive was perceived by the faculty at large. That effort was received as coming largely from people in the university college. And I remember saying to somebody connected with that effort, why don't you guys learn from the way unions have organized throughout our history in this country and abroad for that matter, and adopt one of the tactics, if you want to call it that, which has contributed to the success of unions when they're trying to organize, which is you get the people who are leading the effort to be people who are widely admired for their skill. See, Walter Reuther was a skilled tool and die maker. Harry Bridges was a skilled rigger. And you know, you can go down the line, you can think of other people who led organizing campaigns, and I have always thought part of their appeal to the workers they were trying to organize was these were people who were good at the job they did. And so I'm sure my suggestion was resented. Nobody said so, but it probably was. The point I was trying to make was that, regrettable, lamentable as it may be, the fact is that people in the faculty in the University College are considered by the rest of the faculty to be second-class citizens. See, the rest of the faculty will point to their publications and their research and all these breakthroughs in knowledge they'd like to talk about, most of which is bunk, but at least they publish articles and books and so on, and then they would look at the University College folks who were hired to teach and not to publish. That was their contract. And they looked down the nose at them. And I said, look, think back to the first effort made. A Pulitzer Prize winner was one of the leading spirits in the AFT effort. Is that the phone?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Take the truth stuff shit.
Oh, it's not offending at all. I'm having trouble keeping my mouth shut since I chaired the organizing campaign for the 1982-81 effort, but I'm keeping my mouth shut. It's just hard to do
it
interviews.
It must be very difficult. Yeah, oh God, you poor bastard. But what you're trying to get is the opinion of some asshole who's run there. You wouldn't necessarily expect to agree with it.
No, you're seeking the truth. There's many points of view on what that means. No, I think you're right on some of it. In fact, we did in the campaign against Mackey, and I think that was part of its, what didn't work is, in fact, it got too focused as being personalized. Mm. People thought that would make it effective.
Made him an underdog to some people.
But it over-focused on that issue. But it was, if you look at the literature that we did in that campaign versus the 79, where I didn't have as prominent a role, but I was active, or 78, but...
I'm not sure of the date.
I'm not positive myself, but I've got the files of all this junk. But in the 82-81 one, we did try to highlight in all of those fancy, expensive publications people like your replacement.
Yeah.
That was the first time I met. The next FGO was, we did an interview with him as a scholar and a leading educator sort of thing, who was a supporter of faculty unionization. And we tried to do those kind of little things. Now, we didn't get the biggest stars in the university because they didn't support it, but we attempted that skilled idea. But the other thing that strikes me, and I haven't figured it out myself, but obviously care a whole lot because of the role I play, is why the effort in the early 80s was worse, really, than the late 70s. The vote was even worse for MEA.
I can't figure that out either.
I haven't got it exactly sorted in my head, but we did do that. Mm. People like myself were very much hidden in the background.
Yeah, I always thought Bob agreed with that view, Bob Rebus.
Which view?
That you ought to get some skilled people.
Oh, and we did it. That's my point.
Yeah.
We tried to do it.
Yeah.
Oh, I think it's a good point of view. The point was that we tried to do it. But you're right that it was still perceived as being an effort of AT&L, University College,
Phil
James
Quartz,
Madison's the
good man, but he was perceived that way by others. And there's so much snobbishness and so much arrogance among faculty members generally that that's a hell of a thing to overcome. Now,
I guess the other thing that I keep my mouth shut on the 70 effort, that what you characterized as just a few economists getting together, I think some of us that were active in faculty associates, at least myself, but I thought others, thought it was a much more orchestrated thing that John Henderson was part of, and that perhaps there was administrative support in that.
There might very well have been. I'd forgotten about John Henderson's role.
Oh, that's who I thought you were talking about.
No, I wasn't. I was thinking of Crinan and a guy named Ramsey, who was here at that time, and some other guys who had a very arrogant attitude.
Uh-huh. Well, I was thinking of Henderson,
that,
who you meant.
That letter of theirs. Well, I prepared to say something about the origin of the grievance procedure.
Exactly.
If we've exhausted the
I think we've exhausted it. Do you think there'll be? Do you think there'll be another attempt to unionize the MSU faculty in your or my lifetime?
Oh, I would certainly expect so. Yeah.
Successful, or?
I think one of these days, I think we'll be successful because I think people see right now we're a lot of people are getting a lesson in the hollowness of the faculty governance system. See, we've got a provost who's has a very ambitious program for changing the nature and of the university. And the impression I get is that he will seek to get his changes accepted by the faculty and adopted by a majority vote of the Academic Council and the Academic Senate and so on. But I think he will either engineer a majority vote, or if it isn't a majority vote, he'll revert to the position President Hanna took a long time ago when I think it was in the early 60s, there was an effort to change ROTC from a compulsory program, which it used to be, to a voluntary program for students. And we had about a year-long campaign urging that it be made voluntary.
You and Zoltan were the...
Well, Bob Reapis was very active in that. I don't think Zoltan was even on the faculty then.
Okay.
I was involved in it. There was a fellow named Dick Rudner from philosophy who was very active in it. I think Masterson of math was in it. A guy named Victor Smith from econ, who's not a very liberal guy, as a matter of fact, he's quite a conservative guy. He was active in it because he was a pacifist. That was his interest. Anyway, we had a vote of the Academic Senate finally, after a debate and so on. I forget the numbers, but it was like 60% voted to make it voluntary and 40% to keep it compulsory. And then the president was asked that evening by a reporter, are you going to comply with that vote now? And he says, well, I'm going to comply with the vote as I interpret it. He said, now, there were 500 people at that meeting, and the vote was about 60% to make it voluntary, but on the other hand, there were 1,000 faculty who weren't there, and for all we know, they all would have voted no, so I'm not going to do anything about that. Well, a year later, with no fanfare, no publicity, whatever, he just quietly made it voluntary. So I think the provost probably has been apprised of that way of doing things. And if I'm right about this, then as people become increasingly of the opinion that the academic governance system, which explicitly is only advisory anyway, is really a sham, then I think they may decide if we want to protect our rights and advance them, we better have a union and a bargain with the institution. So I think, now when you say you're in my lifetime, that covers some differential spans of time here. My life expectancy is probably, 10 years? I'm 73 years old, after all. Whereas yours is probably 30 years at least, maybe 40. So if we say your lifetime, no question. In mine, a good chance. So anyway, going back to the grievance system.
Quick question. Does that mean you assume the provost is going to make the faculty vote again on the
change for semesters,
for example?
Oh, yeah, sure.
He's determined to have it.
Yeah.
Why? Or are you unwilling to say it?
I don't know why.
Okay.
See, one of the things that I've been intrigued with in some of the proposals for change that people have made in recent years is I would assume they would make these proposals to save money. But when I ask people who ought to be in the know, these are people who are active in this academic governance system of ours, why is this proposal made, is it to save money? They'd say, no, nobody's mentioned that. And sometimes that's the only justification I'd be able to see for them. Now, they see what they say, what the people upstairs say, if they're asked for publication, why are you promoting the semester system? They'll say, so we'll be on the same academic year as the University of Michigan, and I've even read, I think, the president saying, or maybe the provost, that will make it possible for our students, if they want to take a course in Ann Arbor, to go down there and take a course without having all kinds of problems about how much credit do you give the course and all that. Well, that seems to me to be pretty unlikely that our students would be taking courses down there, although I guess some of them do in the summer, or some of the time, and their students take courses here sometimes in the summer. So maybe there's something to that. But it does appear to me, and it did when it was proposed during the Mackey winter regime, that it is a cost-saving proposal because you need fewer faculty if you teach fewer courses.
I'm not being a good interviewer because I'm going to say what I feel. Because the reason why I posed that, I think part of the issue is simply most faculty went to school in a semester system because most of the faculty here didn't go to land-grant agriculture-based institutions, and that's the only place that you'll find the quarter system for the most part.
Could be.
So I think most of us went, and I was like that. I went semester, undergrad and grant, but I still oppose this change because I'm convinced that the change is coming out of the Blanchard administration.
Probably
and
is,
that the change is to put all the state system on the same calendar. And I don't think they're ever going to come after MSU. We're just too big and prominent. But I think they go after Grand Valley or Saginaw State and say to them, you don't need to have specialists in this part of geography, or you don't need to have this kind of math, because your students could go to MSU.
You can make a case for that, you know.
It's an arguable case, but I think that should be discussed. They're unwilling to discuss it on that basis because they saw what happened. When it is discussed as a money saving and a reduction of faculty are going to be against it.
They're going to be against it,
so
that's right.
I guess on baseline I'm saying I think they're being sneaky. But when I've mentioned this to other faculty, they disagree with me.
No, I think you're right. And I think a next step, after getting all the schools on the same academic calendar, is to do what has been done in New York and California and have a chancellor or czar or something all the four-year schools are under one administration, and you have chancellors, I guess, and the president would be the presiding.
Well, Wisconsin has some.
And the economists would no doubt favor that because they would say that's going to save money, it's more efficient. If you have a strong Russian language program at the University of Michigan, which they do, then you could argue, why have a weak Russian program at Wayne in Michigan State?
There's an oriented unionist
which
has some difficulty
back.
With
sure,
that.
Sure, exactly.
But I'm not even at that level. I'm just saying I think they're not laying any cards on the
they're
table.
They're not being honest with people. I think you're right.
And I think that's...
I'm one guy who agrees with that.
There are few, but many don't. Many don't.
Well, many have their heads in the sand, as we've seen around here in other situations, and they just won't permit themselves to see what's coming, and then when it hits, they act as if it's a surprise. The dissolution of the university college departments is a perfect case in point of that.
Well, or the recent elimination of humanities, social science, and natural
science.
That's
what I mean. Dissolution of those departments,
And the the occurrence now of refugee faculties.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyways, I've interrupted you about...
Yeah.
We're almost done with this side of the tape. Let's just finish the banter, and then we'll do FGO on the other side, on a new tape.
I'm going to have
Or we can do FGO another time if you prefer.
No. Oh, I'm just going to heat some water have some hot chocolate. That's all.
Go right ahead.
Scare us off.
Well, the funny thing about that one was that one proved why at bottom line I think a grievance procedure without arbitration doesn't work because the president decided. But. Yeah. And I'm here to interview you, so talk about the faculty grievance procedure the faculty grievance officer.
The question of unionization and the operation of the faculty grievance procedure are related. And by coincidence, as I remember it, the faculty grievance procedure came into existence at just about the time the first major effort to unionize the faculty occurred, namely 1972. Now, my recollection of how the faculty grievance procedure came into existence is this. In 1969 and 1970, there were three widely publicized instances in which non-tenured faculty were dismissed. And when they went to their department heads and asked, could you give us the reasons why we're not being reappointed, which is a genteel way of saying fired, they were told, we are not going to tell you. We have no obligation to. The university policy is not to tell you why you've been fired, certainly not to put it in writing. And anyway, it's unnecessary because if you reflect on your performance, you'll know why you're not being reappointed. That was the response. Well, there were folks around here who were outraged by that response. And so there were protests and there were demonstrations and there was a lot of discussion in the state news, letters to the editor, points of view and so on, objecting to all this, and it got into the commercial media as well. Finally, after three of those instances of that type, the Board of Trustees, at that time with a majority of Democrats, who had, after all, been elected by the selected by the UAW, which, as I viewed it, dominated the Democrat convention. These Democrats decided it's embarrassing for us, these Democratic trustees, it's embarrassing for us to be presiding over a university which treats its employees the way the auto industry used to treat them before the UAW organized the auto industry. And so the trustees decided that the policy which had prevailed up to then, which I described, of the department head refusing to tell a fired assistant prof why that person wasn't being reappointed, that would have to change. And so they legislated that faculty members in that situation would be entitled to reasons in writing if they asked for them when they were dismissed. And then they instructed the administration to establish, first, to have a committee of the faculty write up a document setting out the rights and responsibilities of faculty members, and in the course of all that, create a faculty grievance procedure. Now, this was done with, I wouldn't say active opposition from the faculty, but passive hostility from the faculty. And I suppose the same 60% who voted no on the union didn't like the idea and didn't see the need for a faculty grievance procedure. And what they could see, what I remember people telling me at the time, if you have this kind of a grievance procedure, then you will be giving instant tenure to anybody you hire because you'll never be able to get rid of a faculty member if you have to demonstrate cause for denying reappointment. And that argument was put forward with great solemnity by a lot of people at that time. So the point I'm making is the faculty grievance procedure is not the result of faculty agitation. It's the opposite. It was ran down the throat of the majority of the faculty by the trustees. Now, you could get a different opinion from some, I suppose, because I have run into people who served on the committee which drew up the faculty grievance procedure. And you might be interested in this kind of a side issue there. See, the idea the trustees had was that the first step in emancipating the faculty from this arbitrary treatment that they were getting, the first step would be to write up a document which would set out the rights and the responsibilities of the faculty. And find it. Yeah. Treat each other more like partners.
Well, you've been doing this. This is your second go-around together. Yeah. You and Betty.
Yeah, and she had that asshole in here for 5 years.
I'm on tape.
By comparison with her, I'm a real fine guy. guy to work with.
Do you want me to erase back on that?
I don't care.
Okay. And you didn't name names, so.
No, and it's not obvious from that.
No.
Whom I'm referring
no,
to.
No, no.
Okay. So anyway, the Board of Trustees, they instructed the administration, have some of the faculty and administrators draw up this rights and responsibilities statement. Well, that turned out to be so difficult and time-consuming that somebody had the idea, why don't we establish the grievance procedure immediately while we work on this other document? So the chair, as I remember it, of the committee which was asked to write up this procedure was Charles Killingsworth of the Labor School, who was a logical choice after all. He was a nationally known arbitrator and expert in labor relations, etc. So when you look at the grievance procedure, you'll see the language comes right out of collective bargaining agreements, which is not perfectly appropriate for a university setting where you don't have a labor union, but it works fine. And they put the title Interim Faculty Grievance Procedure on it, expecting that it would be changed when they got the rights and responsibilities document completed. And here we are 17 years later, and it's still called the Interim Faculty Grievance Procedure. And I'm not sure the rights and responsibilities document has ever been completed. It may have. I don't know for sure. I
can't remember.
But it is certainly the case that untenured faculty, tenured for that matter, do enjoy rights now as a result of all this, which they didn't before. So it has seemed to me that one of the flaws in the procedure, and I don't know, I've never asked Killingsworth about this. I suspect he would have preferred arbitration as the final step, if for no other reason than to give some of his pals in the American Arbitration Association some employment. But anyway, the final step in this procedure is the president. Now, the way it works briefly is a person who has a grievance, faculty member. Oh, one of the things that I think is unique about Michigan State and all this is that the grievance procedure is administered by a full-time faculty grievance official who has an office with a secretary, a fairly generous budget for supplies and so on. Pay is pretty good.
It isn't just regular.
Well, what
salary?
Happens if you're if you're a 9 months faculty member and you're appointed FGO, then you, because you're going on 12 months, your salary is increased by 25%. That's the standard way of doing that. And then, on the reasoning that you probably, I guess, that you should get a little more, they tack on a couple thousand bucks for assuming administrative duties, mm-hmm. the way they do with a director of a school or
right.
a department head. So it's it represents an increase in salary for a person who's on a 9 month appointment to come in here. Anyway, we do have a full-time official, and we have a secretary, and we have this office. I don't know of any other school that has a full-time person. Some have a half-time person. I did a collected grievance procedures from uh-huh. schools all around the country when I was in here before. And I noticed that typically the grievance procedure, if there was one, and most of them didn't have one, would be administered by some faculty committee, which would do this as just one of its duties, and this would be you get the feeling it was a minor function for that committee. So anyway, if a faculty member has a grievance and it goes to a hearing, most of course is settled by conciliation.
Was the full-time person part of the original committee's, the Killingsworth recommendation?
Oh yeah, that
okay.
was in the was original in procedure that was.
Maybe that was the trade-off for not getting arbitration. Maybe somebody said, you can't have arbitration. Well, then we want a full-time.
Well, that could be.
I'll have to ask him.
It might have been, yeah.
I'll have to ask him.
Yeah.
Who knows?
So anyway, a person gets a hearing before a five-member group of faculty chosen randomly. Each side in the grievance has two peremptory challenges of the people who were drawn for this committee. Unlimited number for cause. when that committee hands, and all the requirements of due process are observed. You can have a lawyer if you want one. You can have somebody else on the faculty. You could have your wife or your husband represent you. Some times that's what people do. But you have the right of counsel. You have the right to call witnesses, to cross-examine them, etc. And I think most people would say, looking at the procedure or participating in it, that the requirements of due process are well respected there, observed. So anyway, you get this first hearing. If either side appeals, that goes before another five-member faculty group, again, chosen to some extent in a random way with opportunities for challenges and so on, same way. That decision of that appeal body goes to the president. Now, anybody who's looked at collective bargaining would recognize that to have a procedure like this with the boss as the final arbiter can be a fatal flaw in the procedure, so it's weak from that standpoint. Now, back in 1977, the people in the Human Relations Department who administered the university's anti-discrimination policy had a procedure which provided for a hearing before something called the Anti-Discrimination Judicial Board, and their final step was arbitration, tripartite arbitration. And they had come into existence in 1970. Between 1970 and 1977, one arbitration had been held in their procedure, and that resulted adversely to the complainant. Despite this almost absence of experience with arbitration and a situation in which the administration won the case, for reasons I'll never understand, the anti-discrimination agency recommended to the board, they took the initiative to recommend to the board, eliminate this tripartite arbitration and let the president be the final arbiter. Well, I was the faculty grievance official at the time, and I got wind of this in an indirect way. Nobody directly told me they were going to do that. I just found out about it somehow by the grapevine. So I thought, I had been thinking that I would go to the trustees and try to get them to change this procedure to have arbitration as the final step, and I was going to argue this will be symmetrical with the anti-discrimination policy, and that would seem to me a pretty good argument. Well, here I suddenly discovered they were retrogressing, so I hot-footed it over to the trustees' meeting to make that argument that they should keep arbitration there and add it here. Trustees, oddly enough, chaired at the time by a Democrat, a guy named John Bruff, a lawyer, made the argument to me, and I felt as if I were, you know, a character in a Kafka novel, just so damned unreal I couldn't believe it. They said to me, Lash, we don't have arbitration in the anti-discrimination procedure. You're wrong about that. Well, I was prepared. I had the procedure in my hand. I read to them. I said, look at here. It says, if the either side in the discrimination proceeding is dissatisfied with the recommendation of the board, it may then request arbitration, it didn't say arbitration, it said a hearing before a body, a three-member body. One member shall be chosen by the complainant, one by the administrator complained against, the third chosen by the two. If they can't agree on the third impartial member, the American Arbitration Association will be asked to appoint somebody. And I said, now that is a standard tripartite arbitration panel that you find in collective bargaining all over the country. No, you don't seem to understand. And I said, oh, for God's sakes. I mean, this is the constitutionally empowered body to write laws and ordinances for this institution. I'm a lowly faculty member. This guy is a lawyer. He knows exactly what he's doing. If he wants to pretend that isn't arbitration, how am I going to persuade him? I couldn't do it. So the upshot of it was they took arbitration out of that one and left the president as the arbiter here. So the procedure is weakened from that standpoint. As a matter of fact, though, not many grievances go that far, so I don't know whether you'd call it a fatal flaw or not, but and here's another aspect, of course. To the extent that the grievance procedure works effectively, that reduces the interest or the need that people would see for a union. So I always felt that the better the job I did when I was in here for 4 years before, and the same is true now, the harder it would be to organize a faculty union. Mm-hmm. So if you wanted to improve the chances of organizing a union, you would undermine the operation of this office. In fact, I was asked, by coincidence, you might remember this, I think it was in 82, just on the eve, I think, of an election, the representation election, a student from the State News came over to ask me about the faculty grievance procedure and said, how do you think it works? And I said, well, despite having the president as the final arbitrator, I think it works quite well. And I think the person may have said, well, and do you see a need for a union? I said, no, I guess I don't, because the major reason for a union is grievances. If you're trying to organize a union and you haven't got people who are on fire with a sense of injustice and grievance because the boss won't listen to their problems and their complaints, if you have that environment, you can probably organize. If people are generally satisfied, it's like beating your head against a wall trying to organize them. So, like I said, to the extent that the grievance procedure works well, it does take away from the minds of a lot of people the need for a union.
So which is it?
What do you mean, which is it?
I have no serious problem with cognitive dissonance, if that's the correct term, but...
No serious problem with what?
Cognitive dissonance. Two sets of information on the same issue that are opposite from the same source.
Mm-hmm. Did I give you two sets of...
I thought so.
...dissonant information?
I thought so. I'm not sure if you think it makes sense for faculty to unionize someday or not. Each story
had
a different conclusion.
I think if the administration acts in an arbitrary way and it becomes clear to them that the governance system, which has the appearance of a participatory democracy for the faculty to, you know, involve itself in the decisions, if it becomes increasingly apparent that that's a sham, I think that will alienate faculty who will then begin to become more receptive to the idea that if we had a union, they couldn't make these changes quite so easily.
No, my question was not on what you thought would happen. That made lots of sense.
Well,
I got confused on whether you thought faculty should or shouldn't unionize. What you personally felt, because I felt like two...
I guess I had
mixed feelings.
I thought at the time of those three elections that I had to stand on the sidelines. I couldn't get myself...
Obviously, yeah.
Couldn't get myself interested in it. I don't know, I've had a lot of trouble wondering whether I was right about that or not.
I mean, there are some...
I just really couldn't see a compelling need for a faculty union at that time. I didn't want to come out against it. I wouldn't sign any of this anti-union stuff.
Okay.
But I couldn't quite bring myself to come out for it. Maybe I was too comfortable. See, that's...
Well, you're certainly in the position, if you're the FGO, or had been the FGO, that one doesn't commit lots of energy to something that one feels is a sham. I mean, that... If you have any moral stature or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Well, you may remember I quit because I thought Mackey was making it a sham. In fact, I quit as FGO before that third election.
Mm-hmm.
And said I was quitting because Mackey and I were in such disagreement as to what a grievance procedure was supposed to accomplish and our concept of what a grievance is, that I couldn't work with him. Now, I didn't want to embarrass the guy. He was under attack from all quarters as it was, so I might have been too kind. But I was trying to convey to people that I thought Mackey was undercutting the grievance procedure. Now, apparently not very many people understood that that's what I was trying to convey.
Oh, not necessarily.
It might have affected their vote on the union, and we could have had a real grievance procedure.
I doubt it, Lash.
You detected quite properly some ambivalence there.
That's all.
I commend you for it. And I'm kind of embarrassed that I'd like to know where I stand. How's that?
We can erase that part of the tape if you want to.
No, hell no.
Consistent, unreal story. I'm sure when you did the Bridges thing that you found him to be a man of very complex directions.
And that's why he said the book was full of half-truths, deceptions, and outright lies, because he didn't like that being pointed out, and I wouldn't want you to change that.
That's right. I was teasing you. I was teasing.
Hell no. Anyway, the grievance procedure has worked reasonably effectively, I believe. The president, in fact, has only on a very few occasions reversed a recommendation of a hearing panel.
I just happened to be one of the few.
You happen to know about one of those, yeah. But see, I haven't done this. It'd be interesting sometime to look through the records and see how many appeal panels we've ever had and how the president reacted to the recommendation of the appeal panel. Here's my guess. This office has been in existence 17 years. I don't think there would be more in that whole time, maybe more than maybe six and eight appeal panels which made recommendations to the president. And if, let's say there are eight, I bet the president didn't reverse the panel in more than two. Now, I looked at some when I was in the office back in the 70s, and I asked myself, if I'd been the arbitrator, what if I'd been that impartial chair of the tripartite panel, how would I have voted, or you know, what would my decision have been? I concluded I probably would have decided the same way the president did in those, the ones I looked at. Now, you and I know of a couple where,
yeah,
at least one where Mackey reversed the panel and we objected because we were on the appeal panel together.
Correct.
And we were outraged at his...
Because I don't think they had merits on the administration side.
Yeah.
And it felt very much, yeah, the president was covering up, mm-hmm, for his subordinate being the provost.
Yeah.
Who was covering up for his subordinate the dean.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the way it looked to me too.
Rather than that there were merits. I mean, every case has some complexity.
But you know, but one realizes that arbitrators don't always rule the way we would like them to rule, and so
arbitrator might have split it slightly too.
Yeah,
But
as I said to the Board of Trustees at that, when I was trying to get them to adopt arbitration, even if it wouldn't make any difference how it comes out, they. Procedure is going to have a great deal more credibility with people if you have arbitration instead of letting the president decide it.
See, I'd always assume if we ever got close to unionization, that is I was involved in some meetings with AFT in the late 70s and the early 80s about them getting involved, and basically both times they said no, because they didn't think it was likely enough to be successful and they were unwilling to commit. And the last time they said no, after attempts of meetings of bringing at least two groups together, and there was some attempt to have AAUP and AFT work together.
AAUP would have been a drag on any bona fide union.
Well, but the point was, I think, and I agree, until you have a united kind, a close to united unionization effort, you're not going to be able to be successful because it just has too many directions going. My guess is if we ever have a united faculty effort under whosoever umbrella, maybe it would be Teamsters, maybe it would be independent of all of the current players because they would have to wash the board to have it work.
Yeah.
A directly affiliated AFL local. My sense is that's the time when it came close that we'll get arbitration in the faculty grievance procedure.
Yeah. Going back to something you were saying earlier about the grievance procedure, when I was, when the Board of Trustees adopted the grievance procedure, I was all for it because I couldn't see faculty unionization coming within my academic lifetime. And so when I was nominated to be the grievance official in 1976, I was happy to serve. And when I thought about the conflict between an effective grievance procedure of this type on the one side and unionization on the other, and to recognize that the more effective the grievance procedure, the harder it would be to unionize, I said to myself, for what it's worth, unionization is something in the far future, far as I can see. A grievance procedure is something we could have in the here and now and do some good for a lot of people. And I saw a parallel between what I perceived when I was in college as the difference between Stalinists and Trotskyists, for what it's worth. Now, a lot of people today think a lot more highly of Trotsky than my generation did in the 30s. But the members of the Communist Party USA, whom I knew in those days, were busily engaged in building the CIO. I perceive, because I listened to Stalinists talking about what they call Trotskyites, a pejorative term for Trotskyist, I perceive Trotskyists as people who were against organizing labor unions on the reasoning, perfectly logical if you look at it from that standpoint, that if you have effective unions, you postpone the day when the revolution can be brought about. Now, that's perfectly logical. But I never embraced that because I figured people want to see some improvements in their lifetimes. Most of us are not satisfied with the thought that we'll bide our time and so on, and we'll forego improvements and reforms so that our grandchildren can enjoy the benefits of the revolution. I was very struck, incidentally, when Earl Browder died, and the obituarist of the New York Times, incidentally, Earl Browder had a full-page obituary in the New York Times. Rarely does anybody who dies get that much attention. So anyway, the obituarist had an interview with Browder just a few years before he died, and he said, now, Browder, of course, had been out of the leadership of the party for a long time by the time he died. So this man asked him, Mr. Browder, he said, as you look back over your career as a member and as a leader of the Communist Party, what are you most proud of? What do you get the most satisfaction out of? And Browder's answer was, helping build the CIO. Well, CIO wasn't all that grateful for his contribution, but I always thought the contribution of the Communists was magnificent and to be commended. So, looking at it from that standpoint, I made the case to myself that because, as far as I could see, unionism probably wouldn't succeed on the campus, even if we didn't have a grievance procedure, for the reasons we've been talking about, I would serve as effectively as I could as the administrator of the grievance process.
I would support your side of the debate, and I would note, that I also see, if one were to go back to the beginning of this set of interviews, we talked about other influences. I think there's certain strong moral relationships and similar cuts that are made between sort of, let's say, worker-oriented, but most of them are, Stalinist, U.S. communist,
yeah,
which Stalinist isn't quite a fair phrase, but U.S. communist, well, and U.S. Catholics.
Yeah.
There's certain similarities of certain moral values,
yeah,
and that actually some of what you're saying actually relates to that Catholic upbringing
it
and
does.
Education, too.
I believe that.
I think so.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's being used to dictatorship of the proletariat is similar to being used to a pope.
You've noticed certainly how many people, Louis Boudin's jumps right to mind, will start out as Catholics, become apostates, take shelter in the Communist Party. I've always thought because they felt the need for some authoritarian institution that would give them answers to moral questions. And then they've become dissatisfied with the Communist Party and they go back into the Catholic Church. Now, I started out life as a Catholic Party. See, I didn't know whether being a member of the Young Communist League was being a member of the Communist Party or not. I assumed it was. So I figured I was joining the party when I joined the YCL. Anyway, it took me about 3 months to decide I didn't like the authoritarian method of running the YCL, so I pulled out. But I didn't feel the need of any authoritarian institution, so I didn't go back to the church.
Right.
But an awful lot of people do, and I think of that in, when you made the comment you just made.
Well, but my serious point was that some of the comments you were making.
But many of those
values
are in common, and liberation theology is a reflection of that.
Absolutely.
Pope John the 23rd, I think, expressed that attitude. There are Catholics in Europe who are communists. They don't see any problem being Catholics and communists.
Italy, apparently.
Yeah, because they share so much in common with respect to their human and social values.
Yeah.
And see, you can talk about communalism. You can talk about the communalism of the early Catholic Church. I had spent some time with the Catholic Worker Movement in New York when Dorothy Day was alive, and Peter Morin and other leaders of the Catholic Worker Movement. And that's what they stressed, the commonality of values between the Communist Party and the and a Catholic teaching, if you take it seriously. Now, Dorothy Day, as you no doubt know, was a member of the Communist Party, left it and embraced Catholicism, but she was never anti-communist. And I'd like to think I was never anti-communist either.
And in fact, there were major fights in the church, in the union-oriented parts of the church, between the Catholic Worker Movement and the Association of Catholic Trade Unionists, exactly over the issue of relationship to communism. Because the Catholic Worker Movement was willing to work with them, they agreed on issues, but Act Two wasn't.
Hold that damn thing up. Okay, look at the spine.
On the book?
The spine of the book.
Lashing out the best of
Lance
LaRue.
I don't require that you read it, but
Irrepressible Press.
Okay. What I want to point out to you is this. My definition of a pamphlet is a little publication, paperback, which is not large enough to have a solid spine on which you can write the title of the book. When the thing is big enough to accommodate a squared off spine on which the title can be printed and you can put that on the shelf and you can read the title from the spine, that's a book.
Okay.
That's my definition of a book. So that's a book.
Okay.
And thank you to recognize it as such.
your maritime Great Lakes Unionism doesn't have such a spine, does it?
Yeah.
Is the title on the side?
I believe it is.
I had to write the title on my spine.
Oh God, that's
because it was blank.
That's really embarrassing.
I believe so, but I would call that a book.
I'd call that a book.
Yeah.
It's
that's
about
significant research.
20 pages or so.
Well, not by pages. I would comment in terms of the quality of the content.
That's why this is a booklet. Okay. Well, up yours. I mean, look, I didn't write those columns for boobs, you know. You've got to be fairly sophisticated to understand what I'm doing.
Apparently, many people don't understand.
Well, there are those, sure. But,
but that was.
We could say the same thing about H.L. Mencken. Some people didn't understand him.
Uh-huh.
Probably some don't understand Mike Royko.
No, I don't think so.
See, Royko is really more of a role model.
Is he a role model?
He's not actually a role model. I don't need to have somebody to look to get a copy or anything like that.
No, but there's nothing wrong with having role models.
No, nothing wrong with that.
Not copying.
I just really don't have I don't believe I have a role model.
Anyways, before
we do the similar things. We write satirically about social
events,
issues and events. That's the similar.
Which is why they're so valuable. But I didn't come here to praise Lance.
You sure didn't. You haven't so far. Your record is without blemish up to this point.
How did you?
That way.
I'm just opening up to 107 of lashing out. How did you ever start wearing such interesting clothes?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. I really am. I'll tell you why. See, I always for years, when wearing Hawaiian shirts wasn't popular, I wore them, see, because they're comfortable. And I perspire easily, much sooner than other people do. And I found back in the days when I used to wear a suit, that when I, about 10 minutes into a class, I was sweating, my neck was feeling, I felt strangled with the tie, and I'd have to loosen the tie and take my jacket off. So finally I decided, the heck with that, I'll just wear cotton, ideally just 100% cotton shirts, and I'd be reasonably comfortable. Well, I was doing research on the book about Harry Bridges at that time, and I picked up Hawaiian shirts over there, which were perfect for my purposes, and so I started wearing those before they were popular. Well, that picture was taken when I was writing for the state news, and they were always looking for different mug shots, see, with different hats and one thing and another. They had at that time a student columnist whose name I can't remember now, whose picture showed him wearing that, I think you call that a bebop hat. It's made out of about five or six different colored leather, that cap. And he had a cap like that and shades, and he had a joint hanging out of his mouth. And that was his mugshot that appeared in the paper all the time.
Okay.
Well, he had gone down to Detroit. This was, probably 20 years ago, and had written a column about soul food and I guess that was the main topic. And he caught a lot of flack from black students who said, where the hell does a honky get off writing about soul food?
Uh-huh.
Well, after those letters appeared, he didn't appear in the paper for about a month. And he had been appearing once a week, every week. So when he didn't appear for a whole month, I decided I'd write a column to explaining whatever happened to him. Mm-hmm. See, he disappeared down in Detroit. So for that column, I decided I'll have a mugshot in which I will dress the way he dressed.
Yeah.
So I borrowed that cap from somebody, and somebody gave me an ivory cigarette holder, and we rolled not a real joint, but just a cigarette, and I had that dangling out of my mouth, and then somebody lent me some shades, and that's how I got that mugshot.
That's great. What about the cover or 35 All the Army? Fatigue.
Well, see, that that's supposed to be a gag, putting down the American Legion and the VFW in my way. I regard them as a hopelessly reactionary sort of proto-fascist outfits. So I figured a good outfit when I was writing about the flag salute case or something like that, see, would be to get myself up in what at first glance would appear to be a Legion outfit. So that cap I've got there actually says on it, Vietnam Veterans Against the War, but it looks like a Legion cap. See? Then I've got the little flag, see, like Nixon with his lapel flag, but it's upside down, see, which is a signal of distress. You probably know that. At sea, you turn the flag upside down, you convey that. Then, to round it off, see, I wore on my fatigue jacket there a combat infantry badge. That's a serious medal that infantrymen cherish and have a lot of respect for. You're not supposed to get one of those unless you've actually been up there with a gun in your hand facing the enemy on the ground, see? So we former infantrymen take a lot of pride in having that thing. So that's serious. But then below it is a good conduct badge, which is my idea of a joke. So you're in my day, in the Second World War, if you managed to survive for 1 year without getting into trouble, you got a good conduct badge, see. That's one of the things I don't like. There's a lot of things I don't like about the military these days. One of them is the way they hand out medals to people who really haven't earned them.
Mm-hmm.
As in Grenada, you had something like 800 men in the entire invasion, some of them up in the Bahamas and so on, operating radios, and they gave out something like 1,200 medals. You see, that shows that they don't mean a goddamn thing anymore. So to convey my disdain for this Army policy, in my fashion, which probably doesn't get across to anybody but me, That's the only medal I have. In that picture. I have medals, you know, for valor and Purple Hearts and shit like that. But I thought that'd be a good way to satirize the whole idea of the Legion and the VFW.
I forget, was it you or Z who served on the ROTC committee here?
We both served on
both
the...
Both did?
Yeah, at different
uh-huh.
times.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I was... I think you get on that committee, I don't know whether you get on there by election by your colleagues or whether you're appointed by somebody in the academic steering committee or something.
I mean, it's not considered a plum exactly the same as being on the
pain in the neck
sports committee where you get sent to the Rose Bowl, unless you got sent to wars, and I never heard about that.
No, there are no... There are no plums associated with being
on. Why'd you guys do that?
They call it Military Education Advisory Committee.
Uh-huh.
Now, Zoltan naturally wanted to be on there because he's opposed to the ROTC being on the campus, and he thought maybe he could curb excesses in the military training program. I just thought it'd be interesting. I didn't have any great axe to grind. I was against ROTC in the 60s being on the campus and was regarded by ROTC officers as their enemy.
Mm-hmm.
But I really don't have anything.
I didn't know if you were on there to counterbalance Zoltan or something. And
oh,
you guys
no, we weren't on there at the same time anyway.
Oh, okay.
No, I think I probably would have agreed with him on the issues
uh-huh.
that came before the committee. See, all you do on that committee is you, if the ROTC proposes a course, this committee has to endorse it in order for the course to be taught. So when I was on there, they were proposing courses in military leadership. And I figured, what the hell, if you're going to have officers, somebody ought to instruct them in leadership. Okay, so I had no problem with endorsing a course in leadership. That's one thing you do. Then another thing you do is when the Army appoints somebody to be on the staff of the ROTC organization here, this committee has to ratify that person's choice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, what happens when you're meeting to do that is you get a copy of the candidate's curriculum vita. And so typically what you would find is you're considering the captain, we'll say, who's been nominated to be on the faculty of the ROTC here at Michigan State, and you see that this captain graduated from some college someplace and then took a master's degree, which comes pretty close to being a mail order degree from the way I viewed it. And I noticed all these masters, practically all of them, were obtained in the same two schools. They seemed to be oriented toward granting masters to career officers. And some of the people on the committee would go through the curriculum vita with a fine comb. I see that this person only got a C in American history here. I wonder if that's good enough to be teaching these kids how to take a AK-47 or whatever they do in the ROTC apart, you know, blindfolded. See, I couldn't take all that stuff seriously.
Right.
I figured if the ROTC is going to run their program, and if they're going to train people for military leadership, I'm inclined to let them work out the curriculum and just go along with it. So, see, I'm not responsible. Zoltan is responsible. He would raise questions about some of those things.
Well, maybe he wanted to know what they've been taught about war and that sort of thing.
Well, Zoltan was in the intelligence service in World War II.
Uh-huh.
I was an infantryman. There's no way you can make war nice. Now, the closest we came to it, in my experience, was when I was an ambulance driver in Egypt, where I think we fought the last war, certainly in my lifetime, where there was any vestige of the old gallantry that you might associate with war in the old days. In this sense, we were instructed as ambulance drivers, pick up anybody who was wounded without paying any attention to what army the person was in. And then if you have four wounded men in your ambulance on stretchers, when you get to the aid station, they're going to come off and their wounds are going to be redressed because they were already bandaged up on the front line. You take the person off in the order of the severity of the wound, irrespective of Army. So if the German had lost a leg and there are three Britishers who just suffered minor wounds, the German comes off and gets treatment first. Now, see, that was not done in the Pacific in World War II, where I served later. It certainly wasn't done in Korea or Vietnam. As a matter of fact, you don't hear much about treatment of enemy wounded anymore, do you? It doesn't go with guerrilla warfare. So,
weren't you working for Montgomery, not Patton?
That might have made a difference, yeah. It
was
weren't
you?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it's a British
well,
it's
a British tradition. It's a British tradition. And the Africa Corps, see, had that same
kind maybe of Patton
tradition.
Did it, but I don't remember.
I think
it's Montgomery.
It wouldn't have been his style.
Is
no.
The reason.
Yeah. That's, yeah.
I'm guessing. But
and you're right. It's a reflection of the long-standing British tradition. But I don't think the British behaved that way in Malaysia. See, guerrilla warfare is so different from traditional warfare that this kind of treatment of the enemy, it isn't possible probably. It may not be possible in guerrilla warfare.
Well,
it's so fluid. And you don't have a fixed front line and so on. That may be. But anyway, we're talking about, I thought we were talking about the ROTC and mm-hmm. Zoltan being concerned about what are they teaching about war. I think what you ought to teach people in the military is get in there to win, to don't inflict unnecessarily casualties on people, treat the enemy the way you like to be treated yourself. I think that's sensible. Take prisoners if you possibly can, treat them according to the Geneva Convention. That's what mm-hmm. I would do.
Do you think we don't teach that anymore?
I have no idea.
You haven't been on that committee in a long time.
No. And we never got into any discussion of that, and I would have felt somewhat awkward, I guess, raising that issue. Now that you mention it, the colonel in command, during the 60s, see, I was campaigning along with Bob Rivas off ROTC. So at one point, the officers in charge...
Oh, that's Dan.
Yeah, I don't need it. In charge of the ROTC invited me to lunch over at Kellogg. There were about 10 of them, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, why are you so hostile to the ROTC? Why are you trying to get us off the campus? And I said, I haven't got anything against the ROTC. I'm involved in this effort because I'm against the Vietnam War. You are a symbol right under my nose of the Vietnam War. And so to attack the Vietnam War, I attack you. That's my thinking.
Yeah.
They said, well, we can understand that, but you ought to realize that being on a campus is a really highly desired post for us. And,
sure.
And you, if you drive us off, you deprive us of this opportunity. I said, well...
Well, it also might be the humanizing influence within the Army.
Well, that was the argument given by the people who favored keeping it here. There's some truth to that, sure. There's a lot to that. They didn't make that argument.
Well, I know Bob wouldn't make that argument.
No, some of my colleagues made that argument, and I finally was persuaded by that, and I backed off. Then, see, that was the 60s, see, Vietnam War era. Then, in the 80s, the ROTC officers embraced me for some reason. You might remember they had...
Because you're wearing all these medals in your pictures in the papers.
Well, I think they were impressed with the real medals I have, but in addition to that...
That's what I mean.
Somewhere in the 80s, there was a captain over there who wanted to put on a kind of a PR campaign to make ROTC more acceptable. So he concocted the idea of a turkey shoot, which was not actually shooting at turkeys, but at targets, in which they would compete against me. So he had ads made in which he invited people around the campus to compete in this target shooting competition against a real war hero, which was me.
Mm-hmm.
And he cited my Silver Star, my Purple Hearts, and the combat infantry badge and so on. So all of a sudden I became a friend of the ROTC. And it's fine with me because having having officers in the military who have had an education in a ordinary college does have a humanizing effect. I came around to believing that.
Uh-huh. Anyways, all of this started because I was saying that before our next interview, I was going to ask you
to look
in Lashing Out, which I called a booklet rather than a book, and that got us going here for the last 15 minutes. What I was going to suggest is that maybe for the next interview, you could sort of skim through it, and I certainly will look through it, and maybe just do sort of an interview of sort of the greatest hits of your years of MSU, some of the stories that were fun and interesting. And
happened to read in the state news this morning that they are going to run 8 or 9 columns this summer out of the past.
Of your greatest hits. Yeah, but I thought maybe I could get you to talk about it. I don't want to read.
No, okay.
But I just thought, remembering some of the issues, I'm mainly focused in terms of faculty, students, mm-hmm. if that's okay.
Sure, sounds good.
How's next Friday morning, a week from now?
That'd be good. That's my last day in here, too. So that'd be fun.
Good reminisce morning. Unless there's a big party being thrown, and well, then I'll hold off.
Well, we wouldn't want to have a party in the morning anyway.
Okay.
Would you like to drop in here Thursday afternoon between 2 and 5?
Between 2 and 5.
And have some cookies and...
Is that when you're having your party? I'd love to. Unfortunately, next Thursday afternoon is Jack Stieber's retirement party.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, 3:30 at the University Club.
Oh, at the University Club.
3:30, yeah. So...
I never go to those things.